o'clock, so I think we'll begin now. I'm John Marty, and this talk is on a sustainable society, and I think the note that's posted up there says, with a global population approaching 7 billion people who are consuming resources at an accelerating rate and doing so on a finite planet with finite resources and a finite ability to absorb the damage we inflict, we're on a crash course with reality. The sessions to look at the need for sustainable energy, sustainable agriculture, sustainable housing and land use, and sustainable consumerism, in other words, a sustainable economy. We're obviously not going to get into great depth into every one of those things, but I wanted to talk in general about the direction we as a society are headed and the consequences of failing to address them. And I think one of the reasons we are in this situation, well, we can attribute it to many things. One is the market and how people can sell things. How you can make money is not necessarily the thing that builds a better future for the long term. Our economic discourse in society, our whole political debate talks about whether how you're going to create jobs and whether it's the market economy or its government regulation or whatever. We talk about the need to stimulate the economy. We talk about getting more consumption. We got to get consumption dropped in the recession. We need to create jobs. We got to regain consumption. But there's very little analysis of whether consumption is good or bad consumption. And the failure to examine this, even to talk about it, can lead to some pretty serious consequences. And two of the general areas where that causes a problem is, one is a misguided promotion of consumption without thinking about whether that consumption is good or bad. We measure our entire economy, our gross domestic product, by how much consumption there is. And not all consumption is equal. The more we consume, we assume the healthier the economy. But remember, first of all, consumption was not always seen as a good thing. It's the same word they used 100 years ago to describe tuberculosis. Yeah. It's not a good thing, necessarily. And frugality is something that we were taught was a good thing at one point. Now it's kind of the more we consume, the better. And the George Bush, what can you do to help your country after 9/11? Go shopping. It was kind of the height of consuming for the sake of consumption. And the problem with this measure, one of many problems, but perhaps a good illustration of it, is that if you have two equal societies, equivalent economies in every way, and one of them all of a sudden there's a rash of automobile accidents, that economy, because of the need for replacing the parts, repairing the cars, healing the people who were injured in it, so is going to have a much higher domestic product. Their economy is going to be stimulated because there are more people buying cars and car replacement parts, and more auto repair shops going, and more healthcare dollars spent, and so on. But that's clearly not a positive thing. And we want to make sure that we look at what's a good part of the economy. We want to stimulate the good things. And consumption of higher levels of education is not destroying the planet's resources. That would be a good example of how it is. And because we have this misguided thing where politicians are trying to create jobs, especially in a tough economy like this, we often put public money into stimulating the economy with ways that are unsustainable in the long term. And so I'd attribute a lot of our problems with the short-term thinking to the shallow economic thinking in terms of consumption is good, not is there good consumption versus bad consumption, not is the consumption we're doing sustainable. And as a result, because we don't think of these differences, we don't look at things that might improve the quality of our life. I propose that if we want to develop a sustainable economy for the future, first we should figure out what we value, what improves our quality of life, and what is sustainable, and work in that direction. And I'll suggest that consumption of certain things is definitely improving our quality of life and is sustainable. Those would be things like educational opportunity, or preventive health care, or clean lakes and rivers, safer, crime-free communities. Those are things we often say, well, they'd be good to do those things, but we can't afford it. And we've gotten to the point of we can't afford those parts of the things, the parts of the economy that would be sustainable, to the point that we accept things that we would never have imagined ourselves accepting. We were always the country that was the leader internationally in terms of educational attainment. We no longer are, and not only that, but we're actually going backwards. The current generation is the first time in American history, and we are incidentally the only developed nation globally that has a lower educational outcome for the current generation of students than their parents' generation. And that's not just higher education, that's even K-12 education, that's even high school graduation rates. The current crop of high school kids will have a lower graduation rate than their parents' generation did. That's the first time in our history, and we're the only ones globally in that situation. And so we've accepted those things. We accept a lot of people retiring saying, I wish my kids had a pension like I have. We expect a decline, and we're moving backwards in things. And yet, when we talk about how we stimulate the economy, it's how can we produce more goods, not services so much, but goods. How can we get more faster computers, replacing them more often? If you sell a product, Renita did a talk yesterday on plastic water bottles and how we in this country, something that we used to get out of the tap water for virtually free, we're now spending what would be the equivalent of several dollars a gallon for, to buy in little plastic disposable bottles, and we are using 30 billion disposable plastic water bottles a year in this country. And that's 100 bottles per person, roughly speaking, and some of you may not use it, and these others are using many times that many. That's not pop bottles, that's just purely water bottles, things we used to get out of the faucet and pour into a glass. And so we've got a situation now where we've got to decide, are we going to start thinking about how do we move into an economy that looks at sustainable things and not the unsustainable things? And we have to figure out how to do this quickly. And I'm going to say some of the reasons why. I'm not going to focus on this a long time. But the long term in politics is often been described as the next election. And in terms of business investment, the Warren Buffett, pick a company you think makes sense and invest in it, that's no longer the case. We have companies figuring out with computer programs how to instantaneous trading, so you're constantly moving back and forth money in ways that aren't helping the economy, they're helping make somebody make a buck quicker on the short term. What about the old Iroquois nation concept of the seventh generation? They have a thing where their chiefs were supposed to make decisions for the tribe, were under the consideration of what's in the best outcome for the seventh generation. 7 generations from now, we don't know those folks. That's about 200 years from now. If you can name your great-grandparents, which some of us could, but some of us couldn't, that's only 3 generations back. And yet, who's more important to you than your kids and your grandkids? Well, if you care about what's in their interest, well, maybe you know they're going to care just as much about their kids and their grandkids, and they're going to care just as much about theirs. So the seventh generation of people, even though we will never see them, we're supposed to be concerned about them. And if we think about it, we'd say, yeah, that is pretty important to us. So maybe we ought to be looking at the long term, the seventh generation outcome of things, but we're not. And I'm going to just quickly give you a couple of examples. The plastic bottles that Renita talked about, 30 billion in this country alone, we drink water out of them for somewhere between 2 minutes and 20 minutes, depending how thirsty we are. And then we take that plastic bottle and it goes in a landfill for millennia. And where does the plastic come from? It comes from petroleum resources. And we consume a lot of petroleum products. And petroleum products are getting harder and harder to get. Deepwater Horizon, the rig in the Gulf of Mexico, I don't think anybody really believes BP chose that location because they liked the tough challenge. They chose it because it was the easiest available new reserves of oil that had been discovered. And their projections, their hope, I should say, is that it could produce as much that Tiber well, that Tiber field that they're drilling into, their hopes are it could produce as much as 4 to 6 billion gallons of oil, which is a lot of oil. So they're going through all this difficulty and perhaps destroying shrimp fishing and a lot of the economy of Louisiana for how many years over that and doing untold damage to our environment. Well, assume that that had never happened. They're doing all this work to get that oil out of there, that 4 to 6 billion gallons. They hope the projections, that's rough estimates. They don't know yet. They won't have a sense of that for a number of years. But if they get all the oil out of that well, that will provide all of the world's oil needs for 50 days to 75 days, depending on which estimate is more accurate. 50 days. And that's easy to get oil now of the new stuff. Of course, you've got vast reserves in Saudi Arabia and other places that are going to continue pumping, but they're slowly going down. And in order to keep up with the daily need, we need new resources like that. So we can't keep going at this rate with petroleum. And I think a lot of us can think of other ways we do it. This morning in Bible study, when they were Diane was talking about the year of Jubilee and quoted something about how the land, you are not to sell land in perpetuity. In other words, you are not giving title to the land to somebody. And I think the concept of, are we stewards of this land or are we owners of this land, is something we ought to think about, because I think in our generation we've taken the tack that it's my land, I can do whatever I want with it. I will guarantee anybody who says that won't be in charge of that land 100 years from now. They won't be around to be in charge of it, but we ought to be looking at land use. I think I'm a resident of the Twin Cities, Minneapolis and St. Paul. In my 50-some years of life, I think the land area has grown about tenfold. If I live 30 more years, it may grow another 2 or 3 fold, another 20 fold or so what it was when I was born. We're using up valuable, in many cases, farmland and natural areas, and we can't be using it at that rate. We can't be doing that where people decide, I want to design and build my own house in this beautiful lot. We won't be able to do that 200 years from now. There won't be any land left, because one thing the world is not producing, it's a finite planet, it's not producing more land. So land use or petroleum use, lots of little things we don't think of. Helium. Helium is a non-renewable resource. There's only so much of it available. It tends to be in certain natural gas reserves. Our country is the main place where you can get helium. And it's not something you can recover. When it goes up into the atmosphere, it's in the upper atmosphere and not recoverable. Maybe someday, I don't know. But there's a very finite amount, and yet for a lot of medical and technical processes, you need helium because it's such a stable element and doesn't interact with anything. Will we find other, the other noble gases are less stable than helium, but they're pretty stable. We may be turning to that. But right now, you go to the store and somebody's birthday, you buy a bunch of helium balloons. And saying, well, don't do that anymore isn't going to change anything, because we're not building up the reserves for it, even though it's a one-time reserve. We don't have a chance to renew those reserves. So we have all of these consumption problems, whether it's land or other things. We have environmental lack of sustainability. Again, this morning we were talking about, in the Bible study, it seemed to be a little discussion of sustainable agriculture with the concept of Sabbath for the land. Every seventh year, the land will lie fallow. And somebody in the discussion was talking about, well, they use pesticides nowadays. And in all of these conversations, they seem to weave together. The one yesterday about environment, one of you was talking about how North Dakota, the water in the Grand Land, the groundwater, goes north in some cases into Canada, and we're using pesticides that infiltrate the groundwater that Canadians don't use. Well, we have to be concerned about all those environmental factors, and you have to recognize that all the things that are making this worse is the population growth. I think the year zero, or 2,000 years ago roughly, population of the world was about 300 million people. And it grew very slowly until about 1800, when we hit the first billion people, 300 million to a billion. It took us till 1920s to grow to 2 billion. I was 4 years old when the population of the planet became 3 billion. I entered college the year it turned 4 billion, and next year we're going to hit 7 billion. And we have, again, it's a vast planet. I mean, I think we can be awed at how huge the planet is and how huge those oil reserves and everything are. But 7 billion people is a lot of people, and we're consuming petroleum, we're consuming plastic, we're consuming water, we're consuming land faster than ever per capita. And so you see that we've got a crash course coming, and something we're not going to be able to get out of quickly. So how do we change it? Well, first of all, I think we've got to start the discussion. I think if you look at the political world these days, lots of people, I'm a politician in Minnesota, I care about the environment. The environmental community has been very good about trying to raise the alarm about sustainability. Usually people will focus on one aspect of it, sustainable agriculture and local foods and healthier, sustainable agriculture system. Some will talk about, somebody here has talked with me several times about sustainable population. We all talk about various parts of this, but those of us who are concerned about the environment have to be concerned about all of those, and then put on the political hat of, well, we've got to create jobs. You know, somebody who doesn't have a job in this economy, it's a crisis. And so what we tend to do in politics is to very quickly say, what can we do to create jobs? And somebody comes in selling snake oil, perhaps you might see it, but I'm going to create jobs by doing this. And we put public resources into subsidizing those. Northern Minnesota right now, we've got a copper nickel mine proposal in the Boundary Waters Canoe Area watershed and the Lake Superior watershed. And big talk about that. Oh, well, yes, we'll make sure we take care of the environment long term. I keep thinking the cleanup here in Railroad Creek, 50 years after they closed down the mine, and how much there is to be done, and trying to do the same thing in that environment. I'm not entirely sure that I have confidence they're doing that. The environmental impact statements have suggested that there's a lot more work that needs to be done. But the cry right now is, we got to create jobs, and we got to create jobs now. And so that's where we have to change the whole thinking of our economy. When we look at it, one of the issues we have is public versus private jobs. When I mentioned earlier, sustainable things where we could improve output, where we could improve our production, where we could improve our consumption. More teachers, whether it's early childhood, more people in daycare taking care of children. We know very much that the earlier you intervene with a child's life, the better chance they have of success. We know that if you want to have, laying off teachers in schools is not a very productive way to improve education, and yet that's what's been happening nationwide. Part of this most recent federal stimulus package is to states so they don't have to lay off as many teachers. Chemical dependency treatment, mental health. We don't have the resources to take care of that, and yet we know if we take care of mental health and chemical dependency, you have more productive people. You have lower crime rates. You have all kinds of other benefits, and these are things that we could be doing. What if we were to invest our resources in trying to create a green economy? Like in Minnesota, I've used the example of green energy very much. Every dollar we spend on energy is going out of the state, or at least 99% of them are going out of the state, whether it's to Texas for natural gas, or the western states for coal, or overseas for oil. We are exporting our dollars for that. What if we take those same dollars and use them for energy efficiency developments? What if we use them for new technologies? What if we use them for weatherizing buildings, making our vehicles more efficient? All of those things tend to create jobs, and they tend to be, some of them aren't very sustainable jobs, but they're less unsustainable than what we're doing now. And we have to find a way to reshape our economy that way. And I'm going to open this up for discussion in a few minutes, and we can go into any of these fields. But we don't have a choice of this. The discussion of sustainability right now is kind of, a lot of people in the media, in public discourse would say sustainability. Oh, that's one small faction of the public says they're in favor of sustainable things. Well, what about everybody else? I mean, we all are on the same planet. We all are on the same crash course with use of resources. It may be sold as a fad right now that some people believe in, but the people who say, well, we can consume oil as fast as we want, the drill baby drill line of 2 years ago, we may be able to find deeper water horizons yet. We probably will, and we'll probably be drilling them. We'll probably need to at some point. But we're not thinking about that. We have to find a way to get people engaged in this. And so I guess that's one of the things I look forward to hearing in the discussion about. But I'm blanking on who wrote the book about World War II, Why England Slept. But the whole concept is, while this whole crisis was happening under their nose, why didn't somebody do something? And I think if you look back 3 generations from now, I think people will be asking why the current generation and its leaders were sleeping when all these things were happening, why we allowed this to happen. And to start opening the discussion, I guess I'd like to suggest, I think a big part of that is the fact that we assume that if we don't do thinking about this, who is in charge of it? Well, some would say the invisible hand of the market is what governs things. And the invisible hand of the market is, I'm not sure that it's a hand that's guiding us in the direction we want to go. I'm not sure that it even works that way. It's to go back to the discussion yesterday of the plastic bottles, that was a demand that was created for people. The water we get out of our drinking fountains was good. The water that Nestle and Coke and everybody else and every drugstore and every grocery store you can buy bottled water at, they're taking it out of, in most cases, tap water themselves. And we didn't need that. And now we have a new crisis on our hands with more plastic being used, more money being wasted, more energy being used to haul these products across the country to sell them instead of piping it through your kitchen sink. That's what we've allowed to govern what we're doing now. And it seems to me that what we have to do as a society is say, we want to take charge of it. We want to design the future in a way that serves us as a population. And with that, I'd like to hear people's thoughts. Do you see this as something that this is not hopeless situation. It may be global warming. I think a lot of us are thinking we've got some irreversible damage that's being done now. Every year we wait to address these things, the problem gets worse. Yet we do know there's new technologies coming all the time, new opportunities for how to do it, but we're kind of sleeping at the switch, and a few entrepreneurs are developing new, more efficient lighting, more efficient other things, but as a society, the broader conversation is not talking about this. And I don't watch enough TV to know, but I don't recall seeing anything, papers advertising any TV shows talking about lack of resources in recent years, talking about unsustainability of any of these issues, maybe an occasional documentary, but no news stories on the broadcast networks or anything like that. So I'd like to open it up and see which direction, if you have ideas or thoughts on why we're not doing this and what you'd like to see happen or how, what gives you hope about it. So, yes?
I think that entrepreneurialism will be part of the solution, the creativity that's unleashed in business. There are business schools that are just changing our thinking to a triple bottom line orientation. So it's not just profit, but it's people and planet, with the idea of responsible use and renewable use of everything, and a localism is in there, but there's so much creativity in that entrepreneurial spirit. It's not something that government is going to fix for us, and on our own we can change all our habits, but it's really not enough. But so I'm hopeful as far as what there are some new business schools that are really teaching management in a whole new way.
That is true, and it's encouraging to see. One of the difficulties is, I've been working with some people on some, a new form of corporate structure that would allow, because right now Ben and Jerry's, which is designed to create a product and make money and so on, when they go public and they sell it, they have no control anymore. And the shareholders of any publicly held corporation there are legally responsible to their shareholders. For profit, for short-term profit even at that. If they pay their employees too much above what somebody might call the market rate, because they think their employees deserve a living wage, their shareholders can sue them. If they do something that's more concerned with the environment than they do, they could be sued for it. I'm working on a thing where we create an alternative form of community corporation. Right now, everybody rushes. Corporations tend to go to Delaware, where we've reached the lowest level, the most protective of board members, so you can't sue them for anything except for shareholder rights. To have a system where you can, where you could incorporate. I mean, because you can incorporate, it's just filing papers. In any state, where if one state like Minnesota would create this system, then if I'm creating a new business, I could incorporate under that, and I'd have more flexibility to be responsible, yes, like the people in some of the business schools are doing. But I think you're right. That's a good sign of hope. Yes?
In your discussion, I'm considering just in my own head a relationship of individual and communal sustainability. It seems like as an individual, it's hard to be sustainable at times of making sure that you're not spending more money than what you have income coming in, or your daily schedule is so busy you don't have time to even think of what's next, perhaps, and how to be sustainable personably. But it seems like you need some communal structures to help you be sustainable as well. You have to rely on public transit to some extent, and the community that's around you is for your food and other aspects, but also seems like there's a root of it that's personal as well, of how to personally learn to make sustainable decisions or to live sustainably in some way. So I'm just struck in my mind the individual and communal relationship there.
You need both, yes. If individuals, you can try everything you want. I've been at a number of events in the past year, speaking things on a panel or other things where big head table number of speakers, and used to have a pitcher of water and some glasses. Now they have a plastic bottle for everyone. And, I could think ahead and bring up my own bottle. I don't always think of that. It's something that's much more difficult for somebody nowadays to do that if you don't believe in using plastic bottles or disposable bottles for stuff. You have to go way out of your way to change that. And as you said with the transit, if you'd rather not rely on a car, maybe you don't really need one. If there's no public transit available, you don't have as many options. And I think that's one of the reasons you need the community to set policies that way. And look at the whole issue of food. We are developing, I mean, our obesity rates are many times what they were generations ago. And the obesity epidemic is hitting particularly low-income people. In other words, it's not they have enough food to fill their stomach, but if it's the wrong kind of food that's making them obese and making them less healthy and making them diabetic, saying, well, that's their fault. Well, if the cheapest food you can buy is the highly processed food that's the least healthy for you, in the end, we all pay for it with the emergency rooms and the diabetes and the healthcare costs growing. We need people to take the responsibility, but we also have to have the responsible community structures and the responsible businesses to work together with it. It's a good point.
My husband works in downtown Seattle, and parking is expensive, and the company doesn't want to pay for employees to park, so they pay for monthly bus passes for everyone. But every now and then, he needs to go up to Linwood, which is 25 miles north, and do some work. And in that instance, the company has a subscription to a company called Zipcar, where you can check out a car for 6 hours, 8 hours, I think after like 8 o'clock at night, you can check it out until 8 o'clock the next morning for a reduced rate. It works in, I think it started in Boston, and it started in Seattle as FlexCard, and I think FlexCard was largely a West Coast thing that Zipcar ate up. So if there were a way, and it works at density levels, so if there were a way that government could help promote some more shareable automobile alternatives for smaller communities, like the community I grew up in can barely support bus service because it just there's just not the density.
Yes, the whole concept is kind of sort of we have zip cars in one community, we have our car, HOU hour, car where you rent the car by the hour and so on. And a lot of people, tiny percentage of the population, I might say, a lot of people are using that. If they had two cars in their household, they're using that now. Some of that relies on the availability of either alternatives, either biking or walking, which our development patterns don't often allow anymore. But that's another reason for change, plus need for transit. I have proposed one way that I think the employer that your husband works for is wise in thinking that way. It's probably cheaper for them and cheaper for the community to do it that way. But not every employer is doing that. And one of the things that we ought to be looking at, and you change the dynamic of where transit's feasible if we stop thinking of transit as something where, if we reduce transit fares, make transit more desirable in a variety of ways.
Right.
I proposed legislation in Minnesota a number of years ago, still would love to see it happen sometime, where transit fares would be 25 cents a piece, regardless of the length of the ride. Well, somebody's subsidizing it, yes. In the Twin Cities right now, about 3/4, if you count just the fares as opposed to the operating expenses, if you count the capital expenses, about 20%, about 1/5 of the cost of a transit ride is paid by the fare. Other 4/5 is paid by the system. Well, you know, if you cut fares to 1/4 or so, you'd probably be, you'd double the ridership in a period of time. I mean, you really do. I mean, I think Seattle actually had a free zone at one point.
Still has.
Yeah.
Austin, Texas had one. They had totally free system for a while. They doubled their ridership in 3 years or so, and they canceled the program not because it wasn't a success, but because they were having trouble with homeless people sleeping on the buses. But I think that's what we have to do. That's where you create a system in place where people have alternatives to fossil fuel consumption, and yet the idea, I mean, the cost per ride you subsidize goes way down if you reduce the fare because people ride it. And in the Twin Cities, where we have a relatively poor transit system, 95% plus, if we cut the fares to free or 25 cents a ride, I think you double ridership in 2 years, 3 years. We have, would cause other problems. You need more buses. You need more frequent runs. You need more routes, which is a good problem to have if you're trying to encourage people doing it. And then the more frequent service, the more people can use it. And so it's our Metropolitan Council, the agency that runs transit, has a goal of 20 years from now, they want to double transit ridership from, 3% of rides to 6% of rides? I think you could double it every 2 or 3 years and then double it again 2 or 3 years later. But it's things like your husband's company, it's things like the zip cars, it's...
And the other thing that we saw, that we all lived through, that we saw that really boosted transit ridership was $4 a gallon gas.
Yeah.
And that will be coming again. It'll go higher than $4 a gallon, and it will be more permanently here. And that's, I mean, some people are suggesting, you know, why does the government raise gas tax by 50 cents a gallon or something? A lot of money to use to invest in other things, like, and that's going to look like small change compared to what gas prices will be.
The cost of this moving towards is electric cars.
Yes.
Looking in and going and pushing that too.
Yeah, just
with that zip car business, but they're electric.
Right. I just heard from a friend who's got a business in Minnesota. They're just starting up with some electric car conversion thing where they'll convert Priuses to plug in so they're electric only and so on. But those, again, that gets back to the thing, entrepreneurs will do some of this. You got to create the system so that that's rewarded as opposed to being punished compared to other things. And if you figure in all the external costs, the cost of the pollution, cost of everything else, those would be automatically there, but that's where the market doesn't take care of it without the change.
We seem to move this country kind of two ways. One, incrementally, we've talked about really interesting incremental type movement in terms of transportation. Another way that the country moves in terms of crisis, if you go back to maybe the early 70s, there was really kind of an environmental crisis. We had rivers that were highly polluted, there were rivers that were burning, we had contaminated water, and there seemed to be a real movement then that the Environmental Protection Agency was even started under a Republican, you know, and so there was a lot of national interest in doing that. And then I see other crises that we've run into, the banking crisis, the war crisis. You talked about the crisis that Britain had with World War II. And just an open question, do we see a crisis coming that may force us to really move?
That's my point, is that I hope we see that it is a crisis, because we don't seem to. And the difference between 1970s, early 70s, and the environmental movement was that people were saying, hey, we got to be concerned about this. And people were reading what they were saying, it made sense, and we better be concerned about it, so they got concerned. Well, that's what should happen in a crisis. But now we have a crisis. I think most people, most of the scientists, 98% of the climate scientists would say we've got some problems with greenhouse gases. Real crisis. I mean, people who further north you go, the more you see the dramatic changes in things, they say we've got a crisis on our hands. And instead, there's a whole lot of industry that spends a lot of money to try and say it's not a crisis. BP would say, well, we made a mistake with this one thing, but it's not a crisis with this, and let us do our business. And there's a whole political movement to try and say, to deny a crisis exists, when I think a rational look at it would say it is a crisis. Because the way I'm saying, that's why I'm trying to say this concept of the seventh generation. 100 years from now, we won't have any of these choices. We won't have the choices of where we build our homes, because the land, we've been screwing it up in terms of how much we're using. We won't have the ability of oil, petroleum products, and we will have some alternatives, but you know, I'd say the greenhouse gas issue is probably the biggest crisis, because the entire planet stands or falls with that, and I think it's already a crisis, and we just, some people are out there saying it, but others are saying, they're just fear-mongers, and it's not really a crisis, and you're right. People respond to a crisis unless they're told it's not a crisis enough. They can buy that too.
I concur with the thesis. The thing is that I find so interesting is that I don't see that crisis playing itself out as it has in other crises, whereby everybody's getting behind it. It's clearly certain interests are denying the crisis. It reminds me of the days of the tobacco industry saying, no, you don't get cancer. Smoking doesn't do your harm, or the days of the petroleum industry saying, no, lead in the gas is perfectly fine, doesn't cause birth defects. Maybe you go through all those histories, but somehow we need to get beyond that. I don't know how we get the country beyond the stuck condition I think we're in.
Well, there seems to be a thing that, I mean, there's a whole political movement that says government is evil, and government regulation of business is just slowing things down. I think some people would say, you know, maybe the Wall Street crisis is something that called for more regulation, not less. And yet, I mean, there are a whole lot of people. There's a lot of people who are out there for political purpose saying we should not intervene in this. We don't have to do anything. Oh, if you want to do something to protect the environment, recycle more yourself. We don't have to change anything about how we produce and how we sell and how we bottle water. I think that's the difficulty, is there's now entire industries out there trying to say we don't need this government stuff. Government is interfering with the economy rather than government could be helping the economy. And so I think the crisis is out there. There are people seeing it, and there are others saying, they're attacking the messengers in a sense.
Yes. But, you know, I see that as, you know, to me there's so much polarization in our world now. So, you know, you have the Democrats and the Republicans. You know, there used to be a whole heck of a lot more moderation, and it just seems like polarization just continues to pull us apart in all ways that if there was more moderation, maybe there could be some progress.
I will agree with you. If you have to be able to talk and get along, and some, but when you have two sets of facts that people are, well, we make up our own facts. I mean, there are people who make up their own facts, and it works very nicely, apparently, to make certain points. But I would also say, in terms of moderation, in the current political spectrum, what moderation is that maybe the Zipcar program and the employer doing that, 20 years from now, we'll have twice as many Zipcar programs and twice as many employers offering incentives for employees to take this. With climate change, with population growth, with consumption of resources, we don't have 20 years to do that. It's, again, I get back to, in a crisis, World War II was the last time our country really faced a crisis of unimaginable proportions. And overnight, we retooled the economy. We were in a depression. It was, people were unemployed. We had a lot of problems. And overnight, we changed auto factories into manufacturing, airplanes, everything else. If we have the political will to do that, we could make a bold change, but that's not gonna be, well, I don't wanna offend them, and I don't wanna offend them, so I'm gonna try and find this middle road. In other words, I think we need a more civil and more honest discourse. But it's really frightening. I mean, the poll last week, what did it say? How many, 20% of the public thinks Obama is Muslim?
Well, actually it was higher than that.
What was it?
It's almost 40.
40?
Yeah,
I'm
yeah.
sorry.
Yeah. And it's larger now than it was when you
elected. Yeah.
Yeah.
So. And that's the scary part.
Yeah, there's, how do you make up a fact and you repeat it enough and repeat it enough, and there are people intentionally distorting information like that. And how do you have a democracy when the public is ill-informed
yeah.
people are doing it? That's part of the problem with it. A lot of hands, so I'm going to try and call people quickly. Go ahead.
You talked about the world population growth. Has anybody tried to estimate what the sustainable, long-term sustainable population of the world might be at whatever living standard?
I think some people would argue 7 billion is above the carrying capacity of the Earth long-term. I don't know. I mean, I think the science of population and stuff is too... I don't know that there's enough research. Maybe some of you know more about it where there are numbers of what the best experts are saying. I hear a lot of people saying it's probably less than 7 billion, and the population, the number of births per young mother have gone way down in the last number of years, but we get another billion people faster and faster because the population growth is so large already. And so, but it is...
There's a great disparity in terms of natural resources consumed per person. In this country, we are big consumers. The people in Africa are much lower in terms of consumption, much lower living standard. So, you know, you're talking about different living standards,
right.
Different numbers of people.
And the rest of the world is trying to imitate our
right.
our consumption patterns, India and China, when those two countries, if they come halfway towards where we are, we've...
Talk about them being underdeveloped.
Yeah,
the Chinese have tried to control the population by limiting the children to just
right.
one per family. And I don't know that that's
not a
workable
way.
System either.
No.
But here's one to think about. Why do we sustain life at great age, at great cost?
I'm going to talk about healthcare on Friday. One of the things I've been working on in healthcare is to leave it to doctors and patients, because very few people, when they're terminally ill and in pain, want to have their heart resuscitated when it stops beating. Yet our system in Minnesota, I know that even if I've got a living will filled out saying that I want to do not resuscitate, unless they can confirm that with a family member, most hospitals will resuscitate. Anyway, that's another issue. The population issue is a big one, but the bottom line is China's way of doing it's not a very effective way. The only countries who have ever, since we've learned to beat back diseases and life expectancy has grown a lot, the only countries who have stabilized their population are developed countries.
John?
European and so on.
I was
going to
say, is that woman over on the other side?
Okay, I know. Who is it?
So, I've been hearing a lot about how people are lots of people are apathetic and we're not paying enough attention to the crisis and stuff like that. But I have to say, I don't really think that's true. I think that a lot of people care a whole lot, and a lot of people are dedicating their lives to it. And I think that a lot of people are dedicating their lives to fighting the idea that we're in a crisis, to saying that everything is fine, that it's overblown, that humans can't possibly have a big effect on the environment, and all that kind of stuff. So I don't think it's a question of people just not getting it. I think it's a question of lots of people getting it. Lots of other people may be getting it, but acting in their own self-interest.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say that I don't think... I don't know, I mean, I'm also hearing a lot about, business practices and stuff like that, but it's the fact that people are acting in their own self-interest that is slowing things down, is causing so much, that not just spreading propaganda, but actively working against it in government all around the world, and I don't see that the profit motive, which is, the very basis of capitalism, can be compatible with an actual workable, sustainable lifestyle.
What supports that is the huge gap with our society. We have so many wealthy way at this end, and so many, we have created this wider and wider spread.
Gap
so not only do you have the greed for immediate gain, and they just want immediate profit on it, and there's so much money to support that spin, and we have a whole economy and this what I call kind of frou-frou stuff of our GNP, fancier and fancier resorts, spas.
Right.
I mean, this huge industry that is only accessible for this minority that has all this money that doesn't have to think about it. And they also have all this money to pay for all that spin. And they have all this money so they can delude themselves into thinking they can do a walled community and that they will survive.
Wall off the rest of the world.
Yeah.
Which is, yeah. Well, one of the points I'd like to add to what you're saying, I think you're right, a lot of people care. A lot of people would care if they hear about it. But you look at broadcast, even CBS or NBC or ABC nightly news, you won't see much about this. You look at the local news, you'll hear about a cat being rescued from a tree and an interesting story about some kid. You hear about sports and you hear about weather and maybe one story about who's ahead in the presidential race or whatever race is up the year. And you don't hear a lot about this. And if people don't have a way to know about it, so I think you're right, people who do know about it are very concerned. People do want planet for their kids and their grandkids. A whole lot of people who would care about it but who are denying it and so on now is because they've been told, oh, that's just somebody's political agenda. That's not the reality. So I think you're right. When people are informed about it, when they have a chance to channel their energies into it, they're very engaged and willing to be engaged. They just don't have a way to know about it. I'm going to try and hop around here and go ahead.
And different communities are different too. I'm from Portland, and sustainability is big talk.
Yes.
Portland. Land use planning.
Land use planning.
In many ways, I mean, Oregon's been ahead. Yes.
What's your picture of the role the courts are playing in this sort of the empowerment of corporate consciousness? It seems to me with the Supreme Court saying that now corporations have the same rights as flesh and blood people, the thing in the water movie last night in Africa and South America, the people can get the water companies out of town, but in Minnesota, that where the Coca-Cola company owns the well, the courts keep saying, oh, you can keep drilling while it's in court. I mean, it seems to me almost that one-third part of government has no check on it anymore, and right. It's like we can't pass laws to change how they behave.
Unfortunately, you're right. I argue that money has corrupted our political process very much.
Yes. Yes.
Not by necessarily corrupt people, but it's a corrupt system. So people may be subconsciously, people who give you money, the people who get you elected, are the ones who control things. The president, in the case of the federal court system, appoints them, and the way the political system has gotten so polarized, we're getting justices appointed who think that corporations, which were created by human beings, I mean, this is government of the people, by the people, and for the people, is becoming of, for, and by, and for corporations now. I mean, I keep saying we got all of these problems in the political process, and the U.S. Supreme Court came out in January saying they found a new one, not enough corporate money in politics. I mean, nobody saw that as a problem except the Supreme Court. But the whole issue, I mean, BP and the Deepwater Horizon thing, how much are they going to be fined and penalized for that? A lot. But are they going to be penalized a fair amount? Exxon Valdez case 20 years earlier. The courts, a jury of our peers, people just like us sitting in there weighing all the evidence, gave multi-billion dollar settlement in the U.S. Supreme Court said that was excessive and it would be unstable for the corporate world to have to figure with that. They cut it by tenfold. And the incentive to behave properly, which is what the jury was presumably factoring in, our peers and the courts are doing. I'd say the courts have the same problem the other branches of government have, and that is that money is controlling it. And in the federal courts, it's the case of the presidents who are appointing them. Other things quickly, we don't have a lot of time, but yes.
To highlight that whole process of what's happened in the BP issue and where corporate greed is the controlling factor is when there was legislation attempted to control deep water drilling, the government of Louisiana said, you can't do that because it's going to destroy our work base. It's going to destroy us economically. That's corporate greed. It's controlling what's going on in terms of where we're trying to protect the environment.
And I think a lot of people, my party, would say that we had hoped the current president would be more aggressive about these things, and they're the ones who finally approved the final permit for the Deepwater Horizon thing. BP has their executives, former executives, in every angle in government. I think it's a big crisis that way. Being sensitive to the time, maybe one or two more, and I want to make a couple of closing comments. Yes.
Along with all those other problems, who do you trust in the media? You get this answer and that answer and this poll or that, and you don't know who's giving it. What is the truth?
That gets back to the same issue. People, if they get good information, are willing to do it. And I think we used to have a thing where we could trust it. Now, the other thing is, even if somebody is trying to be honest and fair and everything else, somebody's out there saying, that media is, they're corrupt and so on. And, I mean, I've always figured the liberal media, I've always wondered who owns this liberal media because, I mean, just one quick example. When the federal government gave away the digital airwaves, some said that could be $50, $60 billion. It's a public asset. And the U.S. Congress, Bob Dole, this is 10 years ago or so, Bob Dole and one or two others were the only ones who spoke out against it. You did not see, they made some powerful speeches. You didn't see any of that. You never heard the issue mentioned under the broadcast networks. One or two newspaper stories, one or two PBS things, that was it. You never heard about it, a $50, $60 billion giveaway. Why? The owners of the media don't want it out there. And it's a very good point. Yes?
In my limited reading on the etymology of the word economy and its understanding, it seems like economy is also closely linked with ecology in their roots, is that what is good for ecology is good for the economy and vice versa, that destroys the ecology of something is also in its economy. And also the notion that economy from the Greek is means household, is a notion of the Greek word economy is household. And I think a quote, is, I think to the late Paul Simon was that when the economy is functioning well, it's when a family or a household can sit down to a meal at night and be well fed, is what was a definition of a good economy. So I question, you know, what are measurable marks of a sustainable economy and where that's at? But I think some points might be in ecology and being well fed as a household.
I want to close this by saying that I think we should take this issue, the whole issue of sustainability of the planet. This is the only planet we're going to have a chance. Maybe 10 generations from now we'll find a way to transport people to some other planet somewhere that we can survive on, but this is the only choice we have. And it's got a finite capacity. We are in many ways clearly in petroleum and water consumption and in numerous other things, we are exceeding that capacity now. We are causing environmental catastrophe to occur, and we are in many ways asleep at the switch about it. There are many people concerned about it, many individuals, many businesses, many political movements, people concerned about the environment who want to address this issue. But we have to recognize it is a crisis. We have to recognize that no matter what with greenhouse gases and global warming, even if 99% of scientists are going to say, no, this is legitimate reality, there are certain people, certain industries, certain political folks who are going to decide, we can pay some of these scientists to say the exact opposite. Even if you're not paying them, there's probably going to be 1% who disagrees, and so on. But even if there is only a 50% chance that these thousands of scientists were right, I mean, we are taking away the options for largely the poor. So many of the people who live close who are going to be drowned with the water table rising as global warming occurs. The people who are most displaced, Bangladesh as an entire country is only 30, 40 feet above sea level. I mean, we are going to be killing millions of other people. We're destroying the planet for future generations, and we better treat it as a crisis. And we can have hope because we've had challenges before, challenges that we didn't think we had a chance of addressing. They may be greater now, they may be much more complex now because we have no way of getting information out to people, people not trusting the media not addressing the right issues. We have a lot of people who are very strategically, very skilled at getting out misinformation. But there are, I think all of us have the same thing if we think about it, if we take the time to reflect on it, this concept of the seventh generation. If my kids are important to me, well, what's important to them? It's going to be their kids. And what's important to them? Their kids. And that seventh generation are people directly related to us, people we care, our own families. We better be concerned about them. We have to address this issue. I hope that today's talk gives us a little bit of a thought about, one, the urgency of it, and two, the need to strategically think about it and be engaged in the political and economic and media discussions about this. And with that, I look forward to carrying on this conversation with people either over dinner or in the coming days. So thank you all for your attention.